BCFM Radio reserve the right to refuse advertising from payday loan companies and other businesses that we consider unethical. Email sales at bcfmradio.com for more details.
So these are really the two philosophies that we have competing with each other in the world today. Who brought man the gift of fire? Prometheus. Who was Prometheus? Lucifer. What was the gift of fire? Knowledge, intellect. Hasn't man created industry, culture, society, science from the use of one solitary thing? Fire. Without fire, none of it would have occurred. None of it. Nothing. There would be no society without fire.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Human rights in Hong Kong under the Communist Party in Beijing. Was Goebbels right to say fascism or communism? It's just a flip of the coin. Yes, we're off to Little Hong Kong, which is facing a triple whammy human rights onslaught from Beijing against freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and the right of assembly. Anyone suggesting Hong Kongers should decide who runs their city is a subversive. And if you start talking about independence from China, whoa, that's sedition. We have an exclusive interview tonight with Joshua Wong, who's already done 6 months in jail. He's the leader of the pro-democracy movement, which mobilised around 250,000 young people in 2014, the Umbrella Movement. A decade ago, Libya boasted the best life expectancy and standard of living in Africa under Gaddafi. Now it's mob rule, and many are saying the West is deliberately promoting two rival armed factions to reduce the country to ruin. Gee, thanks, guys, the Libyans say. So who started it all down there? Who was the godfather, the mobster in chief behind the Iraq War? And bang up to date, everyone seems to be warning of preparations for a false flag chemical attack in Idlib to be blamed on the Syrians or the Russians. Israel's teenage online spy and troll army, it's Unit 8200, and their government's 2,700 assassinations and counting, as revealed in Ronan Bergman's new book, Rise Up and Kill First. They include Middle Eastern leaders. How come the Israeli state is confident our London media won't report any of Israel's war crimes? Today's tweet, Martin, from Benjamin Netanyahu, we'll start with that. I'll just read it out. What he says is, the weak crumble, are slaughtered and are erased from history, while the strong, for good or ill, survive. The strong are respected and alliances are made with the strong. And in the end, peace is made with the strong. So what do you make of that statement from Benjamin Netanyahu today? It doesn't sound as if he's got that from the Old Testament.
Well, he also, where he made it is significant. He made it outside the Dimona nuclear power plant, which is where Israel has developed its nuclear program. First of all, of course, by stealing US nuclear secrets, which Jonathan Powell was sent to prison for many years for that. They've been engaging in all sorts of skullduggery in relation to the Iranian foreign minister tweeted back saying, "Well, this is a bit of a cheek. You know, you're standing in front, you're threatening us with nuclear annihilation. We haven't got any nuclear weapons. You have, and there you are threatening us. What shameless!"
So, why is he doing that?
Well, because he wants the Iranians to get the message. You know, we are, you know, we are strong. We can do what we like, and you can't stop us.
I mean, didn't one of the professors over in Israel actually threaten to nuke European cities?
That was
Martin Van Crevel.
Van Crevel, yes, he said what the West has got to understand is we can attack Rome, Berlin, all London with our nuclear weapons, and of course they can. And if that came to that, no doubt we could nuke them back. And they've not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They're not supposed to have nuclear weapons. And under the Logan Act in the US, any nation which doesn't sign the NPT and develops nuclear weapons, all aid and trade with that nation is supposed to be ended. But of course, all aid and trade with Israel hasn't ended, even though they've got nuclear weapons. And that's why they don't admit officially that they've got them, because if they officially admitted it, that would kick in. So, but nevertheless, with Netanyahu standing in front of Dimona, we all know what he's saying. As a good gangster, he's just saying, hey, you know, accidents can happen.
Will they happen?
Well, one hopes that with nuclear weapons, the trigger is so high that once you use nuclear weapons, that nobody would dare to use them. But one, you know, because of you know the consequences. But of course, NATO doctrine has always been not to say we won't use them first. Although it's never been the true of the Russians or the Chinese. And the other thing, of course, is that you can. They've been developing what they call mini nukes, so that they can you know, battlefield nuclear weapons, so called. And of course, the whole trope of weapons of mass destruction is to suggest that the use of chemical weapons or biological weapons is the same as nuclear weapons, and it's a weapon of mass destruction. Therefore, it's the whole strategy of the West has been to blur the line between nuclear weapons and conventional weapons.
Well, look, back in January this year, Martin, we started on a great foot from the Pentagon. Bless them. Saying that they would counter cyber attacks with nuclear weapons.
Well, that's silly bluster. What they mean is that cyber attacks will be treated as if they were, you know, war, you know, kinetic attacks with bombs and guns. Now, I think that's, you can say that. I mean, basically, NATO.
This is the newly drafted US nuclear strategy. Yeah. Cyber attack could be met with nuclear weapons in the opposite direction.
Well, in that case, what the Russians say, well, okay, you fire your nuclear weapons at us, and we'll fire ours back at you, and we'll all go down the drain.
You can guarantee these American generals are going to be down in their bunkers.
Yeah, well, what they're doing is they're arguing in favour of nuclear weapons being used. So, for example, if you think about this, the Iranians haven't got nuclear weapons. If the Israelis were to nuke Iran, the Russians would be in a dilemma. Then, do we nuke Israel? Even though that might bring a retaliation from the United States.
More pertinent is, what on earth would be the benefit of the United States getting involved in a war in the Middle East if it would draw the Chinese and the Russians to attack America?
Well, the fact is that one hopes that the rationale of not using nuclear weapons will mean that they won't be used. And if they're taken off the table, then we're just talking about conventional fighting, aren't we? And with conventional fighting, states have got their national interests. I mean, you know, there's already effectively been exchanges of fire between British and US forces in Syria and Russian and Syrian forces. So we're already fighting.
Well, what the Pentagon is saying is that a concerted cyber attack could actually disable much of ordinary life in America. It could cut off electricity. It could, you know, basically disable people completely. It could make it impossible to get from A to B, that sort of thing.
Well, the same thing could be said, that a cyber attack on the Russian underground, which they've threatened to do. We could carry out cyber attacks on the Russian underground, and they threatened that they would carry out. And the Russians are saying, why go around threatening? The Stuxnet virus, which wrecked the Iranian nuclear program, was written by the Americans and the Israelis, and then leaked out and played a role in the Fukushima disaster. We're already doing this. It's pretty silly. And, of course, the strategic doctrine of the Russians is to actually use electronic pulses to knock out the other side's electronics, because they're geared up to fight without electronics. And that's what they're doing. They're just going back to basics. If you make your systems just think about Snowden walking away with the crown jewels from the NSA on one MP3 stick. That's the vulnerability of having everything.
What you're talking about here is the EMP weapons, electromagnetic pulse. Well, I remember doing an interview with this chap in Cheltenham who'd written the book on EMP weapons. He reckoned that you could explode one of those bombs over the Midlands and everything in Britain would stop, literally within a microsecond.
Well, that's right.
No electronic devices would work at all. They would all be blown out.
You saw what happened to the USS.
And actually, it doesn't have a much of an effect on the physical infrastructure or on people. It's no, just unless they're close by to where this thing goes off. But what it would do, it'd be, for example, you know, every single car would be knocked out.
Yeah, but also you'd knock out all the military infrastructure of the West, which is totally dependent on electronics. Whereas, of course, the Russians, in fact, are relying on things like rocketry.
Now, look, hang on. We heard from Matthew Williams earlier about the bunkers under Corsham and places like that. Now, that won't be knocked out because they're all protected down there.
Well, unless there was a deliberate, you target that deliberately because you know that's the target you're going after. Instead of knocking out everybody's cars, knock out Corsham, isn't it? And, of course, the argument that's used in Iran, we're going to need bunker buster bombs to get into places like Corsham. And they have to be nuclear in order to have to get through the concrete and all the rest of it with which they're protected. We shall see, won't we, what happens if it comes to a fight.
Okay, so I did say we would look at, I mean, this conflict in the Middle East, which is really at the moment is brewing in Idlib and in Syria, really started back in 2003 with the illegal invasion of Iraq and the million or so dead, many millions displaced in Iraq, and absolute devastation of the country. So I thought what we'd do is have a listen to former CIA's Kathleen Christensen, and she discusses who she believed, and she did a lot of work on this while she was at the CIA, and she was privy to a lot of secret documents as to who actually was behind it all. Because I think sometimes we look at what's happening today, but we don't spend enough time just taking one step back and finding what we have has since transpired about the problems, who caused these problems in the first place. So the illegal war in Iraq, who was the mastermind? Here is actually, it's not, I think she's just talking about Kathleen Christensen. I'll give her name at the end.
American author, peace activist, and former CIA analyst Kathleen Christensen discussed the situation in a 2002 article, reporting, "Although much has been written about the neocons who dot the Bush administration, their ties to Israel have generally been treated very gingerly. The Bush administration," she wrote, "was peppered with people who have long records of activism on behalf of Israel in the United States, of policy advocacy in Israel, and of promoting an agenda for Israel often at odds with existing U.S. policy. These people," she wrote, "who can fairly be called Israeli loyalists, are now at all levels of government, from desk officers at the Defense Department to the deputy secretary level at both state and defense, as well as on the National Security Council staff and in the vice president's office." Christensen described the network that Friedman mentioned: Richard Perle, head of the Defense Policy Board; Paul Wolfowitz, deputy secretary of defense, one of Perle's many proteges, described by an associate as over-the-top crazy when it comes to Israel, named by Time magazine as the godfather of the Iraq War; Louis Scooter Libby, vice presidential chief of staff, mentored by Wolfowitz; Douglas Feith, undersecretary of defense, another Perle protege, given an award by the Zionist Organization of America, citing him as a pro-Israel activist; Peter Rodman and Dov Zakheim, assistant defense secretaries; David Wormser, co-author with Perle and Feith of strategy papers for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu; his wife, co-founder of a website run by retired Israeli military and intelligence officers; Elliot Abrams, director of Middle East affairs; Thomas Dine, head of Radio Liberty, formerly head of AIPAC, Israel's main lobbying organization; David Frum, Bush speechwriter who coined the term "axis of evil" for Bush's State of the Union address; Frank Gaffney of the Center for Security Policy, another Perle protege; imports from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a think tank spun off from AIPAC; the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, JINSA, whose high-powered board is often able to place members inside conservative U.S. administrations. The list goes on and on. William Pristol, the Kagans, Michael Ledeen, Stephen Bryan. The neocon strategy papers were dotted with concepts like redefining Iraq and redrawing the map of the Middle East. Author Stephen Green wrote a meticulously researched exposé, turned down by numerous media outlets before finally being published by Counterpunch, describing how some of these individuals, including Pearl and Wolfowitz, had been investigated through the years by U.S. intelligence agencies for security lapses benefiting Israel. Yet, despite a pattern of highly questionable actions suggestive of treason, they continued to procure top security clearances for themselves and cronies. Israeli leaders worked to sell the war to Americans. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and former Prime Ministers Netanyahu, Peres, and Barak all told Americans that it was urgent that Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction program be stopped, and Israeli intelligence agencies fed the U.S. reports supposedly documenting these. The Israeli article I mentioned earlier reported that the goal was far more than just an invasion of Iraq. At a deeper level, the piece said, it is a greater war to consolidate a new world order, to create a new Middle East. The Iraq War, the article said, is really the beginning of a gigantic historical experiment. We're now seeing the outcome. I've only scratched the surface on uncomfortable facts about the Iraq War that some wish to remain hidden, but my time is up. It's time for everyone to learn this information, the larger history behind it, and for all of us to join together to end the continuing drive for Americans to make war on Israel's perceived enemies.
Well, that's Alison Weir Martin from the Remarkable little website, If Americans Knew. And by the way, their YouTube channel was shut down. And then due to a campaign, YouTube had to reopen it again. But what do you think about what she's saying there?
Well, it's pretty accurate stuff.
Dov Zakheim, apparently, one of the main guys behind it all.
Yeah, and of course...
Who is he? We've never really heard much about him, have we?
Well, I think he was actually head of the Pentagon when all the money went missing, wasn't he? I mean, what you've got, a load of people there are dual citizens, so they're both Israeli and American citizens. And quite a lot of it, that's also true in Russia, of course. Lots of the Russian mafia are also Israeli citizens. Now, should you be in a senior position in a big country like the United States if you've got dual citizenship with another country? I mean, we've had Sabrowski on here. Alan Sabrowski used to be head of studies at the U.S. Army War College, and he was saying, "Well, you know, it's pretty clear that the Israeli government runs U.S. policy."
Well, that
we know that, don't we?
That website, If Americans Knew, I thoroughly recommend. And here's an extract from one of their videos. They've done a film called. The website's If Americans Knew. This particular film is called Israel's Secret Internet Censorship War. So we were talking with Darren Jones earlier about the MP for Bristol North West about hacking. But it's quite clear there's a massive operation of trolling and hacking going on based over in Israel and probably in Tel Aviv. Anyway, so let's have a listen to a little extract from that now. This, of course, is a video which was taken down by YouTube. You can now view it again now the channel's been restored, but I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
The Israeli government is involved in numerous internet projects. Director General of Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs, Sima Vaknin-Gil, told a forum of Israeli tech developers to flood the internet with pro-Israel propaganda. When she was Israel's chief censor, she said, "We censor information that is critical to our enemies, who have no capabilities like us, do not have a Jewish brain, and therefore our enemy relies to a large extent on open information." Her ministry has a budget of roughly $70 million to fight what it calls a war on consciousness terrorism. To win it, she said, Israel must use tricks and craftiness. Another Israeli entity that plays a role in covert internet activity is the Israeli military's legendary high-tech spy branch, Unit 8200. This unit is composed of thousands of cyber warriors, primarily 18 to 21 years of age, some even younger. An article in the Jewish press reports that Unit 8200 has developed a great reputation for effectiveness in intelligence gathering, including operating a massive global spy network. Numerous Israeli tech companies, many of them headed by former military intelligence officers, assist in these online spying efforts, sometimes receiving Israeli government funding for digital initiatives aimed at gathering intelligence on activist groups and countering their efforts. To be clear, this is all part of an effort by an occupying government and its military working covertly to achieve censorship of reporting on its atrocities. In 2016, Fortune magazine reported that Facebook, Google, and YouTube are complying with up to 95% of Israeli requests to delete content that the government says incites Palestinian violence. Among other things, Google said it would increase the number of members of its Trusted Flagger program, which enables certain organizations and government agencies to report content. It also said it would increase support for NGOs and organizations working to present a corrective voice. One such trusted flagger is the Anti-Defamation League, commonly known as the ADL, whose mission includes standing up for Israel. The ADL considers criticism of Israel to be anti-Semitism.
Well, I mean, as the final comment says it all, criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. And when Darren Jones earlier mentioned accepting this international definition, it's been used in the US to make anybody who advocates for sanctions on Israel to be prosecuted for anti-Semitism, and they can't. There's all sorts of legal sanctions against them. So I think he's a bit naive about what will happen once this definition's accepted.
What about this?
And the guy who wrote the definition doesn't believe that it should be used in that way. Incidentally,
what about the application of this organization unit 8200 and others, and also this book Rise Up and Kill First by Ronan Bergman. Martin, you pointed out to me that book has given credence to US ambassador's claim that Israel tried to assassinate him in 1980. The objective of a terrorist car bombing campaign was to sow chaos amongst the Palestinian and Lebanese civilian population in 1981 to 82 to provoke the PLO into resorting to terrorism. This is on the Mondavice.net website. So they're saying effectively that the Israelis were deliberately using a terrorist assassination campaign in order to provoke a backlash against them.
And it's from this book. The quote is from the book. And the book itself has received rave reviews in Israel and elsewhere, and it's supposedly, you know, the inside story of Mossad and other intelligence agencies' work over the years, including admitting 2,500 assassinations. That's what they admit to. And of course, they also, in the book, admit that they were planting car bombs in Lebanon deliberately to kill civilians to try and provoke a backlash from the PLO.
Well, one of the most
that is terrorism by any definition.
One of the most horrific actions so far by the Israeli state was Operation Cast Lead, back over Christmas 2008 into the new year 2009. It was a massive 22-day military assault on the Gaza Strip. Now, effectively, this was simply the use of armed forces against tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of civilians. I think it's worth looking at some of the facts and figures now after all that, where we're talking about investigations by independent Israeli and Palestinian human rights organisations. Around about 1,500 Palestinians were killed. More than 5,000 extra on top of that were wounded. We're talking about also 20,000 people being made homeless, something like 3,500 homes destroyed. We're also talking about 18 schools, including 8 kindergartens, were destroyed, and 262 were damaged. It was an absolutely appalling assault by an army against a civilian population, Martin.
Well, they also used white phosphorus. If you remember the films, you'll see them using white phosphorus, which is a chemical weapon. And we've drawn a red line in the sand. Anybody who uses chemical weapons, they have to be bombed, don't they? But the Israelis can use chemical weapons and the Americans could use them in Fallujah. When we do it, it's okay. When you do it, it's a red line.
Well, nobody
it's a load
really
of rubbish,
seems
isn't
to
it?
Speak out against this, except a certain person who's now the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. And here's what he had to say back in the beginning of 2009, a massive rally in London as a response to Operation Cast Lead, as the Israelis were bombing and firing artillery at the civilian population.
And Tzipi Livni has the audacity to tell us that there is no humanitarian disaster and there is no intention of civilian casualties. Every single one of those rockets that are fired from Apache helicopters and F-16 jets are fired at coordinates given to them by their own intelligence. It is a deliberate and wanton act of war. I just want to tell you this message. We demand of our government full solidarity with the rights of Palestinian people. An end to all arms, trade, aid or supplies to Israel, and not just a no renewal of the EU-Israel trade agreement, but a cancellation of that agreement as a country that has violated the UN and international law. And I say to you in my last word, don't stop, don't mourn, organise, act and be active. Internationally, universally, we will support the people of Palestine. Thank you.
Well, that's the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn speaking to a big crowd in London during Operation Cast Lead back in 2009 over the Christmas. That was New Year 2009, Christmas 2008. So 1,500 killed in Palestine, Martin. 5,000 wounded, 20,000 homeless. Well, this seems to be the characteristic of modern warfare sometimes. I mean, particularly, it must be war crimes. Obviously, it is war crimes when a civilian population actually is the target.
Well, that's right. And I think
Zippy Livni apparently said, no, we didn't target any civilians.
Well, I mean, they can say it, but it's clearly clear that's not the case, isn't it? And of course, they're using aircraft as well. I mean, do you remember when Gaddafi said he was supposedly using aircraft against armed uprising in Benghazi, the RAF went in and shot his planes down. Although in actual fact, as the Russians said, there were no evidence that planes were being used at all. The Israelis are using planes all the time, and as the US does. And of course, they're not barrel bombs like the Russians use. This is proper missiles, proper high-tech missiles that really burn people to death.
Let's look at things that have been going on right now, though. Franco-Italian rivalry apparently is fueling this chaos in Libya, according to Gulf News. Growing angle between Italy and France over proposed elections in conflict-torn Libya is underlined by the two European powers' pursuit of their own interests in the oil-rich country. What we've seen is basically like gang street fighting in Tripoli.
Well, that's right. I mean, the fact is that the Western powers all wanted a piece of Libya's oil industry, and they're backing various factions now.
So now we've got colonial powers squabbling over the cake.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what's happening.
Appalling. What about the US and Israel? Are they behind the fresh chaos in Libya's capital?
Well, the point is that the Israeli intelligence services and Western intelligence services are well dug in over there. They've been dug in. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the guy who blew himself up in Manchester, was from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, based in Manchester, because they were invited there by MI6 years ago.
Russians are claiming the Syrian rebels are planning a chemical weapons attack in Idlib, and also the French are starting to weigh in on that one too. The terrorists are storing chlorine to stage a false flag chemical attack in Idlib. One of the diplomats, the Russian diplomats, and Macron has said that France is ready to conduct new strikes on Syria if chemical weapons are used in Idlib.
Well, this is, in other words, the Russians are trying to flag up before it happens. Look, this is what's going to happen.
They did that last time.
Well, they don't take any notes. But of course, as I mentioned earlier, white phosphorus can be used by the Israelis. That's a chemical weapon. When do we do airstrikes on the Israelis if we're going to have this kind of chemical weapons fetish? In actual fact, chemical weapons are irrelevant.
It was the death of
most people are killed by conventional weapons.
The death of John McCain this week as well. He's an interesting character. And they're now talking about changing the name of the NATO headquarters in Brussels to call it the John McCain Centre.
Well, he is a disgraceful warmonger, and all of those who are praising him are basically showing themselves to be disgraceful warmongers. And ultimately, of course, there may be trials like at Nuremberg in the end of all of this. There may well be, because we're going to have to establish a rule of law here eventually, aren't we?
Just running through some of the places where wars have been started that McCain has been involved. Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Western Central Africa, Iran, Bosnia and Kosovo, Ukraine, Russia, North Korea, and bonus, China. Well, China is in its own class with McCain, who's made strange, vague threats towards the country in the past, such as the Arab Spring is coming to China.
Well, the other thing I'd say about McCain is when he was shot down over Vietnam, he was bombing indiscriminately North Vietnamese civilians. He must have killed hundreds, personally. Civilians. because that's the sort of guy he is.
So do you think they will call NATO headquarters after him?
Well, if they do, it's basically a provocation to the people of Belgium, where that's based, because I'm quite sure that they will be very, very unhappy with that. So if they want to go ahead with it, NATO might just break up as a result of all of this nonsense.
Well, I just mentioned China then, John McCain, and we're going to stay with China as we go and have an exclusive interview, which I recorded a couple of evenings ago, with one of the key activists over in Hong Kong, and because Martin and I had a bit of a barney about this a couple of weeks ago, and I just wanted to try and get to the bottom of what it is like over there. And also, I was quite admiring of the fact that local activists managed to get 250,000 people on the streets for days with this umbrella protest back in 2014 for a very simple request, and that was that they actually had a bit of democracy in Hong Kong after many years, and that people from Hong Kong should be allowed to elect the people that run their city. Now, obviously, that wasn't happening when the British were colonial powers, and it's certainly not happening with China. So anyway, let's go now to Hong Kong to this interview I did earlier this week with Joshua Wong, who started with the umbrella protest back in 2014 when he was, I believe, 17 years of age. He's now 21, and he's one of the leading democracy advocates in Hong Kong.
I'm Joshua Wong from Hong Kong, activist and politician, fight for democracy under the threat of China, and last year has just been jailed for around 100 days.
What were you in prison for?
I am in prison because I organized and led the umbrella movement 4 years ago. The massive civil disobedience in Hong Kong asked for a direct election.
Now, how many people were involved in the umbrella movement?
During umbrella movement, more than 200,000 people come to the street on the same time and block the road and led Beijing to aware that Hong Kong people need Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong, and also one person, one vote, to choose the leader of our city.
How come it took so long after the umbrella protest for you to be jailed?
Under legal procedure of Hong Kong, we just recognize it as a sugarcoat rule of law, which means that under the Hong Kong political prosecution, activists might be continued to be, face trial and delaying leaving locked up in prison.
What was it like in prison, and where were you in prison?
I was locked up in the jail for young adult, which means above 18 but less than 21. And when I was locked up in the prison in Kowloon, how those staff of the prison just verbally assaulted activists is the things that I experienced.
It would be interesting to know what kind of prisoners you've got and what is the daily regime in Hong Kong.
Marching exercise, I need to participate every day, and I heard a lot of inmates have been physically assaulted by prison staff, especially on how those prison staff treat prisoners without dignity. That's what I have faced. And what I remember is when they need to do the cross-examination, they just force me to take off all of my clothes, even include my underwear. So what I mean is, when I was in prison, during the cross-examination by the prison staff, I was not allowed to wear any clothes or any pants or even underwear.
So this sounds like a kind of psychological attempt to make you feel vulnerable.
Yeah, that's what I experienced.
What exactly was your so-called crime?
Participating in unauthorized assembly and have been locked up in prison for 6 months. Yeah.
So would you explain, please, what is the status of Hong Kong? We don't see, for example, Chinese troops on the streets of Hong Kong, do we?
That's have happened already. What I mean is the sovereignty of Hong Kong have transferred from UK to China in 1997, and originally referred to the international treaty, the Sino-British Joint Declaration, which promised to let Hong Kong to have one country, two system, which means under the same country, China, but have a separate system compared to mainland China. But I would describe now the one country, two system already turned to be one country, one and a half system. And no matter freedom of association, freedom of speech, or freedom of press, all are under the suppression of China and under the threat of Beijing.
Can you tell us, for example, what newspapers restrictions are? Because, for example, South China Morning Post still publishes. It's quite critical of China, isn't it?
South China Morning Post is not critical to China since it transferred and owned by Jack Ma. And it might be the one who try to stand more moderate on the pro-Beijing side. 80% or most of the newspaper in Hong Kong are owned by Red Capital or tycoons that serve for the interests of Beijing. That's why I would say that when the Foreign Correspondent Club, FCC, would like to invite the activists that advocate for Hong Kong independence to just give a speech in a lunch meeting. And what we are aware is the former chief executive of Hong Kong just issued a statement and to urge FCC not to make any invitation on that activist that advocates on Hong Kong independence. That's why what we are aware is freedom of speech and freedom of press, of course, compared to mainland China and some of this country in Southeast Asia, we are far more better than that. But it doesn't mean that we are not under threat.
Now, at that Foreign Correspondents Club meeting a couple of weeks ago, there was actually a big protest outside by pro-Chinese people from Hong Kong who don't agree with you. They think, and many would agree with them, that actually now, as part of China, it's not appropriate to be talking about Hong Kong independence.
I'm not the one who asked for Hong Kong independence. I just believe that the system of Hong Kong should be protected and to let Hong Kong people to choose the leader of their city. I'm not an activist advocate on Hong Kong independence. But it doesn't mean that the Foreign Correspondent Club can't invite anyone advocates on Hong Kong independence to give a speech. If we believe in freedom of speech, so what's wrong for journalists? Just invite them to the private club to give a sharing. But what we are aware is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of China government just delivered a statement and warned FCC not to invite that activist, which means that the internal operation of FCC is just under the interference of Beijing government, referred to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
But for hundreds of years, the rulers of Hong Kong have been appointed by the British. So really, you can't say that the ruler of Hong Kong should be appointed by people from Hong Kong.
I'm not saying that we need to have the appointed procedure, but as we believe in democratization and democracy, instead of just let the small circle pro-Beijing elite to pick or screen the leader of this city. So what's wrong to let the citizen, the voters, not only electing the legislator inside the Legislative Council, but also elected the leader of our city representing the administration? That's what we hope for. And also democratization, which we recognize as universal suffrage, is the promise of Beijing government towards Hong Kong since and before the handover.
What about the freedom of worship and freedom of religions in Hong Kong?
Hong Kong still have certain degree of religious freedom, but self-censorship become more common in the recent year. As we know that no matter which religions, if they have any branch or organization based in Hong Kong, they might have certain connection with the organization in mainland China. Just like the Christian school, they will try to preach the gospel in mainland China. But there's a warning sign given by the government. If those church or for those religious people, they care or talk more about politics, or have tried to speak for social justice, they might not be allowed to enter mainland China to preach the gospel. That's why self-censorship become more common in the recent year.
Well, that's interesting you talk about social justice, because this is the heart of many religions, is that they don't like the idea of people becoming super rich, whereas the Chinese government and also, of course, Western governments do.
Yeah, but in Hong Kong, it seems more and more leaders of different religions, because they need to maintain the good relations with China government official, which means Guanxi, that we pronounce in Mandarin. It results for those religious leaders they might just enter the upper class circle and not talk about social justice, but just talk about how can at the same time worship God, but also embrace President Xi. That's the tactics for them to enter mainland China to spread their religious ideology.
What about the pronouncement last year from President Xi that anyone who disrespects the national anthem, disrespects the flag, criticizes him, can end up with 3 years in prison? Is that in force in Hong Kong right now? Because, of course, that would mean there is no real freedom of speech. If you can't criticize your leaders, then this is a grave human rights problem.
The law absolutely have been implemented in mainland China already, but in Hong Kong, the legislation process will start on October, which means that for the national anthem law, it will have the discussion and debate in the Legislative Council of Hong Kong. But once, as we know that the Legislative Council is just dominated by pro-Beijing camp, what we are afraid is no matter brainwashing education or self-censorship, or just how violate on freedom of mind and also critical thinking, it will become more common and common.
What is the Legislative Council? Because even though they're running Hong Kong now, they're not really democratic, are they?
In Hong Kong, Legislative Council, half of the seats are directly elected, but half of the seats are owned by the pro-Beijing camp and just serve for the interests of tycoons or China government. What I mean is, since election exists in Hong Kong 3 decades ago till now, in every election, pro-democracy camp versus pro-China camp, pro-democracy camp always get the majority every time. We win in the election to get more than 60% of votes. But under current semi-democratic system, finally, democratic camp become the minority inside the Legislative Council. That's why we have asked for a long and long time and to urge the government to implement through and direct election in Legislative Council. But Beijing just continue to ignore the request and just hope to remain the current election system in Hong Kong.
There are also the representatives, I'm not sure what you call them, is it MPs or something in Hong Kong?
In Hong Kong, we have legislator, or we call them lawmaker. Half of them are come from different district, different constituency. But for others, come from the functional constituency, from maybe business sector, financial sector, or others. And of course, due to the closer ties of the business market between Hong Kong and China, finally, under the red capital domination, absolutely for those representatives of the functional constituency, when they work inside the Legislative Council, of course, they are the one who belongs to the pro-Beijing camp.
Okay, so am I right? Because I think that some legislators have been elected by the people in Hong Kong and then told that they cannot take their seat. In fact, they have been told to leave.
Yeah, that's what my organization, my political party experienced. What I mean is now in Hong Kong, apart from activists being locked up in prison, we also face lawmakers being kicked out from the office just because of their political stand. Last year, including Nathan Law, one of the Umbrella Movement student leader and also the youngest ever lawmaker in Hong Kong history, elected at the age of 23, just being kicked out of office under Beijing interpretation on Hong Kong constitution.
Why?
What I mean is, according to the background of disqualification of legislator incident, Beijing, they just claim that the one who do not take the oath sincere enough might not be qualified. But from the point of view of pro-democratic camp, Beijing government just have to kick the one that they don't like and kick them out of office and cause them to lose the seat.
Now, doesn't that really have echoes across Hong Kong where people are thinking, well, what's the point of me voting if the person I vote for, if Beijing don't like them, then they just remove them?
Yeah, that's why what we experience is since the disqualification of legislator, and the next is activists being locked up in prison. And last August, Hong Kong have more than 100,000 people come to the street again to join the protests, join the rally, and to urge Beijing government stop to suppress on Hong Kong freedom.
You talked about a demonstration recently with 100,000 people on the streets. That's a lot of people.
Last August, yeah.
Yeah. What motivates these people? What were they fighting for on that occasion?
People come to the street, of course, is because of democracy, freedom, and etc. But last August, when more than 20 activists in Hong Kong have been locked up in prison, they just hope to let Beijing and Hong Kong government aware that we disagree on political prosecution. And lock activists in prison is not the way to solve the problem in Hong Kong.
Do you have political prisoners now?
Yeah, in Hong Kong, more than 50 activists are in prison. One point I would like to add, I still have court case need to face, and they schedule the trial day on next year, April, which means I still have chance to serve jail sentence again.
And what is it for this time?
Also umbrella movement.
Do you feel like you are fighting against the tide, Joshua, because you're fighting Beijing? It's one of the most powerful political forces on the planet, and really it's a very tiny country, Hong Kong, and many people in China point to you and say, well, really, you're just like a Trojan horse for the West, for America, for the British.
I would say that Hong Kong, no doubt, is a small and tiny city, but with the special position and the uniqueness, we deserve people around the world to care more about Hong Kong and how the people in Hong Kong, it seems to be just a financial center. But after the umbrella movement, I believe more people were aware that Hong Kong is also a place with people, that they deserve democracy and they deserve human rights. That's what I believe. That's why I think when under the trade war and under the China model being more attractive in the recent year, I believe it's time for people to look towards Hong Kong, the city, stand on the forefront to react on the rising of China.
Some people say the umbrella movement, and maybe even your own party, is really funded by the American, the British, the CIA. What do you say to that?
According to the pro-Beijing newspaper, they claim that I am not only funded by CIA, I'm even trained by CIA and trained by US Marine. Yeah, it's some of the propaganda by the pro-Beijing camp, and I will say that it's not true at all, and we will not receive any donation from foreigners. We just receive donation by Hong Kong people. And I think refer to this kind of rumors of I being trained by CIA, I would say that compare my body size with Tom Cruise, I believe even the pro-Beijing camp do not believe that I have been trained by CIA agent or US Marine.
Now, lots of people are concerned about China. That's true, because it's not a democratic country. And also, we're seeing some extension of the powers of surveillance, this kind of thing. Something called a rage helmet that you have to wear at work, where if you're starting to feel upset, then your boss can detect through your hat that you're feeling upset and may sack you. Also, an enormous amount of surveillance going on in the west of China. In fact, even overtaking London, having more surveillance cameras than London, which is quite exceptional. What is the state surveillance system like in China? Because I know it's not so much in Hong Kong, and I wonder, is it also coming to Hong Kong?
State surveillance system have not been fully implemented in Hong Kong, but absolutely it is already being implemented for a certain month or a certain year in mainland China, but it already showed the differences of Hong Kong and mainland China. And Hong Kong, I would say that even the surveillance system do not fully implement, we still strongly worry and concern about how the agents from China, they might be based in Hong Kong. And in previous day, we refer to the Causeway Bay book publisher incident, book publisher in Hong Kong, just because of publishing book that seems to be a bit sensitive on President Xi and just faced the result of being physically kidnapped from Hong Kong to mainland China. That's why even in Hong Kong, we have not yet fully implemented surveillance system. It's still hard for us to ensure our personal safety. Once we are the one who advocate for freedom of press, freedom of publishing, and freedom of association.
Last week, the United Nations talked about 1 million Uyghurs in Xinjiang, I think, the Western province, being taken to re-education camps. The United Nations is certainly getting concerned.
Why do people need to be re-educated? It's because under the propaganda and narrative of Beijing, it just allow everyone live in China to follow the order and loyal to the communist regime. That what we worry and the things that we don't want to be implemented in Hong Kong. And according to what United Nations, they show the concern. I believe no matter Hong Kong, Taiwan, Tibet, Xinjiang, or other city or places that is in the coastal area of mainland China, I believe we need to have more solidarity and let the world aware that under the rising and expanding influence of Beijing government, they need to take the closer eyes on what is happening in this few city.
Joshua Wong, anyway, Martin, you had a few things to say about the Uyghurs and Xinjiang province, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, we mentioned it the other week, or you mentioned it. In actual fact, what I've discovered this week, the UN has not, in fact, claimed that the 1 million people are being held in re-education camps. It was just a UN meeting, which is not part of the main structure of the UN, a US person who was actually linked to very extreme anti-Chinese views in the US claimed that 1 million people were being held. Now I listened very intelligent young fella there, but of course, you know, he doesn't necessarily know what the CIA gets up to, and the CIA are determined to try and bring down the Chinese regime if they can. Trump is determined to try and bring them down, and they're not wrong to be paranoid about it. On the other hand, of course, they'd be much better off letting people like him have their say and trying to find some kind of compromise with them.
Let's go back to listen to Joshua now. Now, you talk about, and many people talk about, the Chinese Communist Party, the communist system in China, but actually, for many people, they look at it as more of a capitalist system. It seems to have been more successful in capitalism than the United States, where China are holding much of the American debt. Does it really make any sense to still talk about Beijing as a communist?
It depends on you choose to understand or analyze Beijing on which political perspective. Of course, it is still the one who strongly advocates on communism, on words, by slogan or by propaganda. But if we need to reveal on the economic system, absolutely, they implement a state capitalist system that to try to expanding the influence, and especially in the trade war, you see how the tension between US and China. So I would say that the China model is a mix with the propaganda of communism and nationalism. But in fact, from the economic perspective, it just enhancing state capitalism.
When we saw the talk at the Foreign Correspondents Club a couple of weeks ago by the Hong Kong Independence Movement, at the same time, the Chinese Navy was doing some of the biggest exercises it's ever done, quite close to Hong Kong. But Beijing said that this was only in response to the United States also doing big exercises with their Navy.
Refer to the Navy exercise of both US or China generate more people fear on national security program. That's the agenda to push forward the Article 23, the national security law to be implemented in Hong Kong. That's the agenda.
What made you decide to take this course? Because it does seem to me, Joshua, it's almost like a David versus Goliath exercise you're embarking on here.
It's not only David versus Goliath, it's David versus 10 or 100 or more than 1,000 Goliath in the recent year under disqualification of legislator, being locked up in prison, and also faced the kidnapped incident in Hong Kong. That's what we're afraid and fear on. But what motivated me, I would say that I remember the new words, the new vocab choose by Oxford Dictionary last year, youthquake. I believe youth in the world, no matter they live in which city or country, they can make change and let the world aware that what is meant by universal value, just like democracy and freedom. I would say that as the one who born and live and love Hong Kong, what I hope is to be the master of my own house instead of allowing others to dominating my future. I hope Hong Kong new generation can really be the one determine our own destiny instead of allowing Communist Party or Beijing government to control our future. That's why we hope one day we can through our vote to choose the leader of our city.
But President Xi, he would say Joshua Wong is unpatriotic. He's a traitor to China.
I would say that under Beijing propaganda, absolutely, I'm not patriot enough to love the country. But absolutely, it's hard for us to love the regime, but we can through our action to show our love to people in this city. That's what I try to do. And I believe that Hong Kong, according to the Sino-British Joint Declaration, we deserve one country, two systems for 50 years. So when 50 years end, I'm not sure what will happen. But from 1997, the year of Hanover, to 2047, it might be the end of 50 years unchanged policy. I believe around 2047 is still the day that my generation can be the master of our own house, and we can still recognize ourselves as Hong Kongers.
Well, that's pro-democracy leader Joshua Wong from Hong Kong there. Pretty impressive that managing to get a quarter of a million people out onto the streets and to spend the night for days on end out in the street blocking the traffic. Really just simply over, Martin, the main thing this was all over was whether or not the Hong Kong people were going to be able to decide their own fate. But China is saying no. The most recent news from Hong Kong is that the five Occupy protesters, this is from 2014, the wheels of justice has turned very, very slowly in Hong Kong, quite clearly, even slower than here, have just been found guilty of contempt of court in a trial earlier disrupted by a photo-taking incident involving a mainland Chinese woman. I'll put a link up to that on our show page and also put the full interview with Joshua Wong on our podcast at thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8. This show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gossing. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.